The copies. So last week we did the story of, well, we started Parshas Bahaloscha, which was about the menorah. We did that last week, the week before, about Aaron lighting the menorah. And today we're going to continue with another sort of, it's a bit of a story-ish story in the parasha. We're going to get to the stories soon, really. But just one quick thing before we move on. I saw a very interesting little article written actually by Rabbi Avadia Yosef. Very cute. He was explaining a little bit about that beginning of the parasha, and he said something quite beautiful. He said that when we spoke about Aaron, and it said that he used to light the menorah every day, and the pasuk said that he did so, right? Kein asa, you know. We said he never changed. Rashi said he had the consistency to continuously go in and light the menorah with the same enthusiasm. So he explains it in a very beautiful way. He said, imagine if you were Aaron, and you would come into the Mishkan every single day. And when you entered the Mishkan, so there's two aspects to this. On the one hand, as soon as you enter, what do you remember? Unfortunately, because remember we said, we didn't learn this in depth, but we said that on the day that the Mishkan was actually dedicated, Aaron lost his two sons, right? Nadav and Avihu passed away in the Mishkan. Do you remember? Because they brought the wrong sacrifice, they weren't supposed to bring it, and they passed away in the Mishkan, which was a terrible, terrible tragedy for Aaron, losing his two sons. So every time he would walk in, that probably would be something that he would jolt his memory, and that's what he would remember. Not only that, but he would remember also his nephews, which is connected to our story, Elitzafan, Mishol and Elitzafan, who had to take out the bodies so that they can be removed from the Mishkan. So you could imagine that it would have jolted Aaron in a way where he wouldn't have been in the best of moods to start his service. And nevertheless, despite that, well, either Hashem gave him the strength, well, for sure Hashem gave him the strength, but Aaron found also within himself the ability to refocus and be happy and feel privileged to serve Hashem and be able to light the menorah. And he explains also on a sort of nicer way is that when Aaron, because he was such a great tzaddik, would come into the Mishkan, he wasn't like us ordinary people who, when we enter a holy place, we feel a little bit holy. But Aaron would have been able to see the great revelation of godliness. And yet, despite that, he was still able to keep his hands steady and light the menorah properly and not get distracted by all the great revelations that were happening around him. And he brings a very cute example. He says a very interesting thing. He says, a very interesting story that there was these are great Sephardi leaders in Syria. There was in the 1800s, Ezra Atiyah, Rabbi Ezra Atiyah. He tells the story of the great rabbi of Aleppo, Shlomo Laniado, lived in the late 1800s. And he used to lead the davening on Rosh Hashanah and blow the shofar. But then when he got, frail, so he appointed his son and he stayed home. And when davening was finished, the people came to his home to get a bracha from him and to wish him good yantif, chag sameach, I'm sure they would say, in Aleppo. And he would give them a blessing. And he asked them, how was the davening? So when he asked them how the davening was, they said, oh, it was beautiful. So that means his son did a good job. But then he asked them, how was the shofar? So there they emmed and awed. So obviously it wasn't so perfect. So when his son came home, he asked his son, what happened with the shofar? What was the problem? So his son said like this, that as he was about to blow the shofar, when we blow the shofar, we say Yehi Ratzin, and we say that the angels that are coming out of the blasts, right, they should accomplish all the great things that we want them to accomplish. When we blow the shofar, there are certain angels that come to help us to take the sound of the shofar up to Hashem. So he said when he invited the angels to come, all of a sudden, he saw the angels. And he got all he got all to tumult because of the angels were right there near him. So his father laughed and said, you invited the angel and you were afraid of him? So it was interesting how he obviously was quite a tzaddik to be able to see this malach. And nevertheless, what his father expected was what happened to Aaron, that even though he had such a great revelation, he should still be able to serve Hashem. I mean, that's a very high level. And not get all, to tumult. And there's a very cute story he brings of Reb Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev. I don't know if true, whatever. He says something cute. He says that every single year on Pesach, coming to Pesach now that Purim is over. So Reb Levi Yitzchak, we know of Berdichev, was a very, obviously was a very holy man. He's known more for his obvious role, but he was a very, very holy man. And when he did a mitzvah with such incredible enthusiasm, like his whole self was in the mitzvah. So when it came to the Pesach Seder, his wife, obviously after the first year or two, saw what happened. She had a very interesting thing she used to do. She used to set two tables because they had guests. One table she set beautifully with all the finest, nicest things and the nicest wine and the good matzah for eating and everything. And another table she set with the more simple, all the more simple things and the matzah and the wine that he would actually be saying the Haggadah on. Why? Because it's described that when Reb Levi Yitzchak would get involved in the Seder, and especially when he got to the part, you know, matzah zu, you know, so you touch the matzah, he would get so enthusiastic that he would first of all reach over and knock over the wine, and the matzah he would almost crush from excitement because he was holding matzah zu, matzah zu, matzah zu. He was like reliving the whole Pesach experience. So by the time he finished that part of the Haggadah, that table wasn't usable, not the wine was usable, not the matzah. So then they would go to the other table that was all set very nicely for them to have their meal. Just a cue, no, but the idea being that we don't see deeper. I mean, most of us don't see deeper, so we know things are happening. So for us, it's easy just to, you know, to keep on track. But when you're a great tzaddik, and you're still getting all these visions and all these amazing things, and to be able to do something properly still is hard. And that's what it says about Aaron, that he wasn't distracted, and he, even though he was enthusiastic, he still was able to light the menorah every single day properly in the Mishkan. Okay, it was just a cute thing that was fascinating thing. And as we are coming to Pesach, okay, and that's what we're going to talk about today. But just before we get into the Pesach that we're going to talk about today in the Chumash, everything's such a Shlacha Pratis, we are going. I just want to tell you something orally, because in between the Menorah and the chapter that we are going to do, we're going to do Perek Tes. There is Perek Ches in Chumash Bamidbar, which we will not do inside. That talks about the initiation of the Levim. Remember, because we inaugurated the Mishkan, right? The Mishkan was dedicated. And now there's one thing left, and that is a special process by which they purified the Levim and dedicated them. And it's fascinating thing, but we're not going to go into detail about it. It says that Aaron had to literally wave each of, which means lift, up and down, right and left, 22,000 Levim in one day. How that's possible, I don't know. But it says that shows us the strength of Aaron. He obviously was a very strong man as well, physically, and Hashem gave him that strength. But this was all part of the acquiring of the Levium. Remember, it really was supposed to first be the firstborn, and instead, the Levium were now going to be sanctified. And now they were going to be purified, and they were sprinkled with the ashes of the Paraduma, so there was no impurity. They were waved, they were dedicated, and now they were ready to do all of their service, all the different work that they would do in the Mishkan. And it also says that the Levium actually started, I think it was the age of, from 25 to 30, they were like apprentice, and then from 30 to 50 was when they did the actual work, like the bringing of the sacrifices and all the heavy work. But then from the age of 50, they didn't. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, beautifully, the Levim were still active even after the age of 50, especially in the choir. As long as they were able to have strong enough to be able to sing, doesn't matter what age they were allowed, they could come into the Beis HaMikdash and be part of the choir. Didn't matter about the age as far as that. So very interesting. That's that part. So now we come to what we are going to do inside, and that's Perek Tes. So you can see on page 1, we'll read some of the Psukim, and the topic of Perek Tes in Chumash Bamidbar is Pesach Sheni. But we'll see. It doesn't start with Pesach Sheni. It starts first with Pesach. Okay. So I just want to make this that, and we can see clearly here. Okay, so we have like this. This chapter that we're going to do, these psukim, is first of all, just to put in context, they're in the desert, right? As we know, that's what this whole chumash is. The Jewish people are in the desert. Officially, they're still supposed to be entering Eretz Yisrael very soon. They haven't done the sin of the Meraglim, right? They haven't yet. That hasn't happened yet. So they weren't yet sentenced to being 40 years in the desert. So to put it in context, when does this this chapter happened. They left Egypt in the year 2448, right? We know. They celebrated Pesach, they left Egypt. Then they went to get the Torah, so they left Egypt in the month of Nisan. Then they traveled 40 days, then they got to Har Sinai. They received the Torah in the third month, the month of Sivan. Then unfortunately, a very short time later, they do the sin of the golden calf. And then we know what happens on Yom Kippur of that same year. So we're talking still 2448, that first year from when they left Egypt. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down the third time from the mountain on Yom Kippur and gives them the second luchais, tells them about building the Mishkan, which they do. And as we said, the Mishkan was inaugurated literally almost at the end of that first year. And then we come into Reish Chodesh Nissan. That's when it actually is able to stand. So now we're marking a year almost since they left Egypt. Now, this thing, let's see where this takes place. So now this takes place, you can see, in Pasuk Aleph of Perek Tes, Vayidaber Hashem, so it's on your page, Vayidaber Hashem on Moshe b'midbar Sinai. So Hashem speaks to Moshe in the desert of Sinai, when? Bashana Hashemis, the second year. So now we are already the second year, which means that they left Egypt the year before. So now they're coming to almost celebrating the second opportunity to have Pesach. It's really their first commemoration, because the first Pesach is the experience, right? And this time it's not in Egypt anymore. When Bashana Hashenis Letzeisa Meretz Mitzrayim, the second year from when they left Egypt, Bachodesh Harishon, in the first month, which means in the month of Nisan. And here is the instruction. Just before we go further, I just want to like this, that this, we're going to see, Rashi has an interesting question, but this Pesach that they kept here, we're talking about bringing the, when we talk about Pesach, we're talking specifically about the Korban Pesach. Obviously, everything goes along with it, the matzah, the maror, similar to what we have, but mainly the idea is the ability to bring the Korban Pesach, the actual sacrifice. In the desert, over here, as we said, really they thought they were going to be going into Israel very soon. That was what the hope was. So here, this would have been the last Pesach that they would have kept in the desert, and the next Pesach should have been in Israel already, right? That's what they thought. And the truth is that when Hashem told them, commanded them, to keep Pesach over here, it was actually a specific command for this Pesach. This wasn't a command which would continue onward, because really, when would they become obligated to keep Pesach continuously is only when they enter Eretz Yisrael. It's just important to keep in mind that it's a special command specifically for this time. Okay, so let's see what Rashi tells us. This is an important Rashi to give us a little bit of context of what's happening here. So Rashi says like this, B'chodesh Harishon, in the first month, Parsha Shebereisha Sefer, the parsha, the passage at the beginning of this book, meaning all the way at the beginning, we read it, of Chumash Bamidbar. What was that about? That was when the Jewish people, right, they were going to be told exactly how they were going to camp, right, how they were going to travel in the desert, right? What does it say there? Loi Nemra Ad Iyar. That was said in the month of Iyar. We know that the month of Iyar follows the month of Nisan, right? Because Iyar is the second month. So what do we learn? And this is being said in the first month. Lamadita, you have learned from this, She'ein Seder Muktam U'Me'uchar B'Torah, there is no sequence of earlier and later in the Torah, which means that the events in the Torah are not presented in chronological sequence. Because if it is in chronological sequence, since this happens in the first month, and that happens in the second month, this should have been at the beginning of the book, and that should have been here in the third parasha, not the other way around. Why is it the other way around? Over there, they're talking about already traveling and how they're going to camp and how they're going to go, and here, and the counting of the Jewish people, but that took place in the second month. So it's a bit strange that it's totally out of order, and Rashi, the words of Rashi are quite exact. He says, we learn something. It's very interesting. We learn because the truth is we've had this concept before in Chumash. We know Chumash is not a history book, but here there's something special. We'll see that it teaches us a deeper lesson, but the point is, there's definitely no order, no sequence, that's for sure. And then he says another interesting thing. So now, even though we know there's no order, but nevertheless, Torah doesn't just go out of order for no reason. There has to be a reason. So why didn't the Chumash begin with this, right? If this happens first, the Chumash should have started with this story. So Rashi tells us something very interesting. Why did we begin with this passage? Because this is, and the word gnus is quite a harsh word. Here they translate it discredit. It's actually like an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment for the Jewish people. Because the entire 40 years that the Jewish people spent in the desert, they only brought this carbon Pesach once, this time, this second year. In other words, this one time was the only time, Bilvad. They didn't bring another one until they entered the land of Israel. Now, just on a simple level, what's important to remember is why that happened was because it says like this, that fascinating thing happened in the desert. You know, in the desert, even though, you know, we know that they traveled, right? And we know when you look at it that the truth is that there were a few places that they spent a lot of years. It's not really that they were constantly on the run. That's the truth. But nevertheless, they never knew when they would have to travel, right? They would look at the cloud, they would look at the fire, and then they would just have to go. Whenever it was time, when Hashem signaled, they went. So they couldn't predict. So what would happen if a baby was born in the desert and somebody had a baby boy and they would want to make a bris? They couldn't make a bris, because they didn't know if that day they would have to travel, and that would be dangerous for the baby. So the babies in the Midbar didn't actually have a bris, because it wasn't safe to do so. And therefore, somebody who doesn't have a bris and somebody whose child doesn't have a bris cannot do the Korban Pesach. So they couldn't do the Korban Pesach in the years in the desert. It's a fascinating thing. It says that, I don't know if it was part of the punishment or what it was, but you know, there's something called the Ruach Tzfainis, this wind from the north. It's considered a wind which causes illness. And apparently it wasn't closed, so to speak. In other words, it blew in the desert. Even though they were protected by the Anani HaKavayt, nevertheless, that could have been dangerous for the baby. That was another thing. So they didn't actually bring about, they didn't do a bris in that, and therefore they couldn't bring the Korban Pesach. So here Rashi says like this, interesting. So just to put Rashi in a nutshell, and we're going to analyze this Rashi soon, because it's actually a very deep Rashi and has many beautiful lessons. What Rashi is saying is that Chumash should have, technically speaking, started with this, because this comes before. This is the first thing in order of chronological order of what happens in the desert, right after they sort of set up the Mishkan, and then, well, obviously they should be keeping doing Pesach, and yet it doesn't start with this. And then it says, why not? Because this is something negative. What's the negative here? That even though it's very nice, they keep the Korban Pesach here, but this is the only time they keep it, and the rest of the 40 years, they don't actually keep it. So interesting, one of the commentaries, the Tosfos says like this, says fascinating thing. What was so negative? They didn't have a choice, right? They couldn't keep it. So he says the negativity is really on the fact that what it does is it highlights that they actually sinned, right? That they did the sin of the Meraglim, and therefore they couldn't enter the land of Israel, and that's why they were spending 40 years in the desert, and that's why they couldn't bring the Korban Pesach for 40 years. So in other words, it's not directly on the concept of the Korban Pesach, it's more that this shines a light on, it sort of highlights their sin, and that's why it's negative. But we want to understand it a little bit deeper, because Rashi seems to be implying that it has something specifically to do with this story of the Korban Pesach. And also, Rashi also seems to be highlighting something that it seems, according to Rashi, that perhaps this should have been the first thing that the Chumash opened with, and yet it's not. And why should we even think that? Okay, so we're going to come back to that. I want to read a few more psukim to see what's really happening here, just to get some of the pshat. Okay, so let's see what happens. So he says like this in Pasuk Beis, Vayasu b'nei, so it's page 2. Vayasu b'nei Yisrael es ha-Pesach b'mayadai. So the children of Israel shall make the Pesach offering in its appointed time. This is what Moshe Rabbeinu is commanding them. And what should they do? What is the appointed time? Ba'arba asar yayin b'chaydash hazeh, on the 14th day of this month, bein ha'arbayim, in the afternoon. They need time. It was an amazing thing. We don't even realize, but all the Jewish people would bring this sacrifice in the same afternoon. And it all had to be done by that afternoon. You could imagine how hard the Kohanim were working that afternoon to be able to accomplish that, because then they would have to eat it later on, right? So it was mad what was going on there. And it must have been so precise, everything running exact, to be able to accomplish that. So as he says, you start as soon as you can, Bein Arbayim, Tasu, Aysa, you shall make it, B'mayaday, in its appointed time. Kechol chukaisav ukechol mishpatav. We'll see Rashi says, according to all its decrees and according to all its laws, Tasu, Aysa, you shall make it. What does it mean, its decrees and its laws? So if you look into Rashi on the bottom, chukaisav, interesting, Rashi says, you know, the word chayk is many times translated as a mitzvah or something that we don't necessarily understand. So he says, what is that referring to in the Karban Pesach? He says, Elu mitzvahs shebegufay. These are the commandments that apply to the body of the actual carbon of the animal, that it has to be a perfect lamb, right? Setamim, Zohar ben Shana, a male within its first year, all of those laws about the actual animal. That's chukaisav. What are mishpatav? So here, we'll see in the bottom, they tell us something interesting. This has to do with the, you know, it's something fascinating that sometimes we don't think about. Rashi lived in the year about 1,000, right, in France. I mean, you're talking about, right, 1,000 years ago. There was no printing press. There was no anything. And besides the fact there's no printing press, you're talking about a Jewish people who lived in different countries and went through so much, as we know when you learn the history of the Jewish people, and so much persecution and so much traveling and so much upheaval. The fact that we have the commentaries the way we have them is actually a miracle. It's absolutely a miracle. Besides that, it's a miracle that they were able to write it when they did, but even the fact that it remained, and obviously some things did get lost over the generations. We did lose many, many things, but nevertheless, what we have is beyond. So when we have certain things, sometimes there is discussion that the version is perhaps not 100% correct. You remember, these things would have been hand-copied, one from another to another, given. It's incredible. It's beyond incredible to imagine and to think that what we have, and it's the authenticity of what we have even, is incredible. So you'll see something interesting here. So here Rashi says, this, according to this, it says, like, Zukachol Mishpatav, and according to all its laws, Eilu mitzvahs sha'al gufay, these are commandments that are on its body, which means that have to do with the offering itself, mimakim acher, indirectly. So for example, the fact that we have to eat matzah for 7 days, or the fact that we have to get rid of the chametz. But if you look on the bottom, the commentaries of Rashi say, no, that doesn't make sense. That's not the correct version of Rashi. Something went wrong in the copying over the years. What does mishpatav according to Rashi? So I'll show you. If you look at number 6, it says like this. The text follows virtually all extant editions of Rashi. However, the Ramban, who lived a little over a century after Rashi, about 2 centuries before the printing press, already noted that the popular reading was a copyist's error. And very interesting, and then the other commentaries also agree, the Mizrahi, and he says like this. So what does Rashi say according to the Ramban? Because he knows what would make sense. He says, Chukaisav is, as we said, that has to do with the actual animal. That makes sense. But when you're talking about Mishpatav, this is mitzvahs, as we say, sha'al gufay. What does that mean, mitzvahs that have done to the animal? It's on the next page. We say, like, the fact that it's roasted by fire. In other words, how you treat the animal after you have chosen it, what you're doing with it. It sounds technical, but the reason I'm highlighting this is just to show you the fact that we have one difference, how many things we don't have difference. In other words, how much we have that is so exact is literally miraculous. It's unbelievable. But interesting thing, he says, Rashi then points out that there is a third category of Pesach-related commandments, which are not mentioned in our pasuk, which means those are the things that we say that are not directly connected to the carbon itself. That's what they write inside. In other words, the fact that we have to eat matzah, the fact that we have to eat maror, but that's not hinted to in our pasuk. But the bottom line here is really what we're talking about over here is that Moshe Rabbeinu is commanding the Jewish people that they should keep the Pesach properly with all of its laws that he had already dictated to them and he has already taught them. He's repeating it here because here's where they're actually going to do it. Okay, let's go back to page 3 because I want to read a few more of the psukim. Let me just see if that's what we're up to, or we are up to page 2 still. Okay, yeah, on page 2 we have Pasuk Dalid, Vayidaber Moshe el Bnei Yisrael. So then we continue from Pasuk Dalid, we go to page 3, La'aseis HaPesach. So Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the Jewish people to do the Pesach. And as Rashi says, why is it saying this? Because he's repeating it here, because here's where they're going to actually do it. It's actually an interesting thing, because it's something that we can learn. Sometimes, you know, we tell somebody something, let's say, it could be anybody, we give an instruction, and we want something, right? And we give them an instruction a week before, and then a week later is when they actually have to do it. So we think that, oh, well, for sure, if it matters to them, they'll remember. I don't know, if you talk to children, or talk to a spouse, of course they'll remember. You see, we learn from Maisha, no, you don't have to be so, you can repeat it, it's okay. Because people don't remember. And you can repeat, and you can give them clear instructions again, it's okay. And if the Torah does that, and if Maisha Rabbeinu does that, then we can also do that. And here Maisha Rabbeinu is telling them, because here is where they're going to actually be doing it. So he's giving them the instruction again. Now we see in Pasuk Hey, Vayasu es haPesach Barishayin. So now they're actually doing it. They made the Pesach offering in the first month, Barbas Tarayin, on the 14th day, Lachaydesh of the month, which, as we know, the month of Nisan, exactly at the time they said, Beina Arbayim, in the afternoon, Bimidbar Sinai, in the desert of Sinai, Kechol Asher Tziva Hashem es Moshe Kein Osu, everything that Hashem commanded Moshe, so they did, Bnei Yisrael, the Jewish people. Okay. Now, this was all a lead up to the next part. Here we come to the famous story. So again, putting in context, we are here. This is the first time they're actually keeping Pesach when it's not the Pesach experience itself. It's the second year in the desert. And what happens? So they're told to bring this beautiful sacrifice, and it's an experience, and it's an opportunity, and it's such a tremendous mitzvah, and everybody's very excited, and they do it. But we know what happens. In Pasuk Vav, the famous story, Vayihi Anoshim. And here we'll see exactly how it's said. There were men. Asher hayu tmeim lenefesh adam. They were impure, and it says specifically what type of impurity? To the corpse, a human corpse, which means it wasn't a very low level of impurity, it was a very high level. In other words, if they were just impure stam, it wouldn't have been a problem. But the point is that they had such a deep level of impurity, which was the highest level, as we know, when you're to a dead body, and therefore they can't bring the carbon, right? So what happens? V'lo yochlu la'aseis ha-pesach b'yayimahu. They couldn't do the carbon Pesach on that day. V'yikrevu lefnei Moshe v'lefnei Aaron b'yayimahu. So they come close to Moshe and Aaron on that day. So they have a problem. They can't bring the carbon. They're tamei lenefesh adam. Interesting, Rashi stops on interesting thing. It says they come before Moshe and before Aaron. If you say that, what do you imagine? How did it work? Like, practically. They come before Moshe, and they come before Aaron. So what do you picture them doing?
They're together.
Okay, so you said that. Is that what you picture from the way it says it? Do you think so? It's interesting, Batsheva.
That's what I would have originally pictured until you asked it.
And then you think, yeah, maybe not. Okay, so the truth is like this. So the Rashi says like this, that the truth is, it sounds like, because you know why? Because it says, Lifnei Moshe vilifnei, and before Aaron. So some people might make a mistake and think that first they went to Moshe, they didn't get the answer they wanted, or Moshe didn't know, and then they would go to Aaron. So Rashi says, no, it's like what you said, it's impossible. If Moshe would know, Aaron for sure would know. So it must mean that they came before Moshe and Aaron, sitting side by side next to each other. They're presenting their problem to both of them. Because it's not, you know, just because we know who's the greater one, so it's impossible. Okay, so let's see. And what do they say? And they present their issue. So they say like this. Vayayimru ha'anoshim ahim. So those men said to him, a love to him. So it's interesting, they're addressing Moshe, even though they're Moshe and Aaron there. It's fascinating. You can see they're addressing one of them. And what's their words? Anachnu tmeim lenefesh adam. We are impure to a human corpse. Lama nigara, the famous words. Why should we be left out? Why should we miss out? Why are we going to lose out on this tremendous opportunity? Levilti hakriv es karban Hashem, by not offering the karban of Hashem, b'mayadai, in its appointed time, b'soich b'nei Yisrael, very important words, amongst the Jewish people. You can see what's bothering them. They're upset that they're not able to bring the karban Pesach, but they're also upset, you can see, that through that they're separate. You realize they're different than everybody else. They're not participating in what everybody else is doing in this tremendous mitzvah. And this hurts them terribly, very, very badly. But it's a funny question. they themselves are stating they're impure, right? So what is it? Obviously they can't bring the carbon. They know that. So what are they saying? What is it that they're saying here? It's funny. They know. I mean, obviously they're upset, but they're coming before Moshe. That means that there must be a solution. They think there must be something that can be done, or they must feel justified in one way or another that they should be able to bring the carbon. But if they're impure, how could they? What justifies in their mind? So who are these people? That's the big question. Why are they impure? Who are they? This is a big question. Okay, let's keep that in mind. Okay, I want to go into the see. Let's see quickly a little bit more, and we'll see what Moshe. Let's see the pshat, and we'll see what Moshe says. Vayomer aleihem Moshe. So Moshe says to them, "Imdu ve'eshma." Beautiful words. Stand, and I will hear. Ma yitzav Hashem lachem. What Hashem will command you. In other words, just hold on. I'll make the phone call. I'll find out what the answer is. It's exactly what it is. It's unbelievable. I have to read this Rashi, even though we skipped a few other Rashis. But this is so magnificent. Let's see if it starts on the page before. You know what? Let's start. Yeah, let's do the Rashi Lama Nigara. Let's do Rashi. It's on page 3. Sorry, go back to page 3 and let's do Rashi 7. Rashi Zayin Lama Nigara. So first of all, Amar Lahem, Moshe said to them, Ein Kadoshim Kraven B'tumah. The conversation, Rashi is adding the words because there's so much missing. Sacrifices may not be offered by one who is in a state of impurity. It's obvious, right? So what do they say to Moshe? Amrulai, they said to him, Yizrak Hadam Aleinu, Yizorek, sorry, Hadam Aleinu, let the blood of the offering be thrown upon the altar for us, B'kaihanim Tahirim, by Kaihanim who are pure, right? We are impure, but they are pure. V'yeyachal habosar l'tahirim, and let the meat of our offering be eaten by those who are pure. That's interesting. In other words, they're implying that they will be able to eat it. Because when will they become pure? That's right, tonight. Maybe we're impure now, but we're not going to be impure for long. Very soon we will be pure. So if somebody could just do this first part, then we can join with everybody else for the second part. That's, see, here we see already why they feel they have some kind of a claim and why should we miss out? That's what they're saying. And therefore, so what does Moshe say? Amar lahem, so Moshe says to them, so now we go to page 4. Imdu ve'eshma. Stand where you are, and I will hear God's response to your request. So here Rashi has to stop and say that's so magnificent. He says, Kitalmid hamuftach l'shmaya mipi rabbi. It's like a student who is assured of hearing a response from the mouth of his teacher. And he says, Ashrei yilud isha. Fortunate is the one born to a woman, in other words, a human being. Shekach muftach, who is assured in this manner, shekol zman shehaya roitze, haya medaber im hashchina, anytime he wanted, he would speak to Hashem. How do we know that Moshe was so assured? What words does he use to them? What does he say to them? It's very interesting language. What does he say to the people who came to him? I mean, what would you say if somebody came to you with a difficult question that you don't have an answer? A lot of times, what do we say? I'll get back to you. I'll call you later. Come back later. Come back in an hour. What does Moshe say? Stand and wait. You see? Stand. What does it mean when you tell somebody to stand? It means, especially stand, not sit, not make yourself comfortable. Stand. That means you think you're going to get the answer very quickly. They're not going to be waiting for very long. This is what's incredible. It's not just that he knows that Hashem will answer him. He knows that Hashem will answer him when he asks. Whenever he wants, he asks, Hashem answers. It's beyond incredible. That's why you can tell them, stand, just stand here a second. I'll get back to you right away, which is beyond, it's an amazing thing. Okay, so what happens? Yitaka turns to Hashem, and let's see what it says. That comes in the next pasuk. But then he says an interesting thing. Rashi has a fascinating thing here. He says, Ura'uya haisa parshazu. We're going to obviously be learning about Pesach Sheni. We know that, right? Hashem is going to tell them that you can bring the carbon the next month if you're Tameh. The question is like this, that most halachas in Torah were taught to Moshe directly, right? Like Hashem says, this happens, you do this, you do this. There is a few exceptions, and this is one of them, that it doesn't come about by direct instruction. It comes about more by like a story happening and a request and like initiated by the person, and then there's a response from Hashem, which teaches us a new halacha. This is not the normal way that Torah works, because Torah, especially when we're talking about biblical mitzvahs, they come directly from Hashem. So here Rashi tells us something else beautiful. He says like this, this passage was fit to be said by means of Maisha, which means Maisha alone, like he should have been the one, like he taught everything else, like the rest of the Torah. But these impure people were privileged, and that it should be said by their means. In other words, they should be the vehicle, right? They came to request them, then Hashem had to answer them. Why? In a beautiful language, shemegalgalin schus al yedei zakai, for we bring about that which is worthy by means of one who is worthy. This is a very, I know it's very commonly brought, but it's a very famous thought in Torah, a very famous perspective in Torah, that if somebody is worthy, then what happens is that Hashem uses them to do more worthy things. And if somebody's unworthy, unfortunately, sometimes Hashem uses them to bring about unworthy things. What's very magnificent about this is because this is something that a lot of times, you know, sometimes a mitzvah comes to your hand. Somebody asks you to do them a favor, or there's something, or you become aware of something that's needed in the community, and you become aware of it, so you feel motivated that you have to be the one to do it. And sometimes in life we can think, well, it seems to be like it's always coming to my door, you know? Why am I the one that always seems to notice this lack, or why am I the one that this person always asks? And sometimes you can feel a little bit like it's too much or resentful, whatever. Here you see the perspective is exactly the opposite. If you are the one that is in the position and becomes the one that is able to bring about some positive, whether it be a positive change or helping somebody, it's because you deserve it. Because Hashem is handpicking you to do that job. So megalgalin schus al yedei zakai. And that's something important to remember. It's like the idea we always say, mitzvah goyeres mitzvah. But what this means is that the more good, in a way, the more good you're going to do, so the more work you're going to have. And it's the way it works. You can see it. It is that way. But the beauty of it is that it's actually a privilege. And here, these people, they were getting rewarded. What was it that they were doing? So I want to show you something. I'm sorry, we have pages today. Numbers, Baruch Hashem, so I can skip. I want to show you something. I want you to go to page number, let's see which one it is. I think it is, go to page number 8 for a minute, because I want to just show you inside. Who are these people? Why are they tummy? And we'll come back to the psukim. What is it? What were they doing? So this is there's a few opinions, as everything in Torah. We don't have just one opinion. Who were they? What were they doing that they became impure, that made them unable to bring the carbon Pesach? So if you look on page 8, there's a little bit of underlines in Pasuk Vav. It says, V'yi anashim. Look what the Evan Ezra. The Evan Ezra always has a very simple, straightforward explanation. So he just says, it's not possible that the camp of the Jewish people should be so big, and right, it was quite a big population of 3 million people, and that somebody shouldn't die every day. In other words, it could have just been anybody. That's what the Evan Ezra says, because it's inevitable that somebody will pass away, and therefore somebody who's involved in the burial would have become tummy. But that's not the most opinions that we know have a different view, and they have a very interesting thing. So let's see the Baal HaTurim. He gives us it in a clue. He says, Anoshem Asher Hoyu Tmeim L'Nefesh Adam. He actually says it's the gematria of Elu Shehoyu Noisin Aroinoi Shel Yosef. Who were these people? These were the people, and it's the same gematria. If you want to do it, it's a long gematria, so I'm not going to do it, but this is the gematria, he says, of those who were carrying the coffin of Yosef. If you're carrying the coffin, you're impure. But that's the greatest privilege, to be the ones to carry his coffin, hopefully to be able to bury him in the land of Israel. So that's why you can understand why these people were upset. We're carrying the coffin of Yosef, and we should miss out and not be able to bring the Korban Pesach. Doesn't sound fair. So that's what they were saying. But that doesn't fit with the other thing we said, Rashi. Because Rashi said that they were going to become pure that night. So who are they then? A different opinion. Do you remember we said who passed away on Rosh Chodesh Nisan? Remember this, when they dedicated the Mishkan, who passed away that day? Do you remember Aaron's two sons, Nadav and Avihu? And who schlepped out their bodies? A I don't know if you know, this was their first cousins, Elitzafan and Mishal. Mishal and Elitzafan, who were nephews of Aaron, another brother. So they were, not nephews, sorry, they were the cousins of Aaron, actually. They were sons of another brother, like Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, and then their cousins of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, Mishal and Elitzafan, the sons, the children of Uziel. They schlepped out those bodies. So they, that's actually, it's interesting how it works over here, if it's 7 days, 14 days, but the bottom line is, it seems to be, perhaps it was the seventh day that they died, whatever it may be, they said, we're going to become pure tonight, and just because we did such a big mitzvah, we should miss out. We took out these bodies of these great tzaddikim from the Mishkan so that the celebration could continue, and we should miss out. So you see, these are the different opinions. And there's a third opinion that says actually that we don't know who it is, but there was something called a meis mitzvah. This is a concept where somebody doesn't have a relative, doesn't have anybody else, and somebody extended themselves and became impure for them. And they say, for that, we should miss out. So whatever the case may be, it was something where they felt like they shouldn't be the ones to miss out because they're doing something so big, they should miss out on a mitzvah. And that's what they're coming to present to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, you know, if we're already on this page, I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to just go back to page 7 for a minute. I'm going to show you something interesting, because we mentioned the idea of the timing, of how this works with the timing, that this is the first month and that the beginning of the Chumash is the second month, and everything seems so out of whack. So the Sfarnu has quite a beautiful idea. And I won't do the whole thing inside, just a little bit inside. The Sfarnu says, the Chodesh HaRishon, after they appointed, Achar Shepakad Anshei HaTzava, so after the people of the army were appointed and all of the, you know, the Seder had to go, remember how we said how they organized, how they were going to camp, how they were going to travel, how they were going to carry the Mishkan, and all the different things about going into the land, and the fact that they would purify everybody in the camp. It says an interesting thing. After the Chumash tells us all of those things, that didn't happen first, but the Chumash tells us those things, Sipur HaKosov Dalid Ma'asim Tovim, then the Chumash tells us about four good deeds Sha'asu Yisrael, that the Jewish people did, Shebahem Zochu Likanes La'aretz Miyad Bilti Melchama, that because of these great deeds, the Jewish people were supposed to merit to enter the land of Israel with no war. Imagine they could have entered the land of Israel and all of the nations would have just ran away, left, and everything would have been an amazing, peaceful way of inheriting the land. That's not what happened. Unfortunately, because we did the sin of the Chet of the Meraglim, but in the order of things that could have happened. So, what are the four special things? So he says, first, as he says, Lulei HaMeraglim, if not for the Meraglim, K'moshe Hayid Moshe Rabbeinu, as Moshe Rabbeinu himself testified when he spoke to his father-in-law, Noisim Anachnu El Amokim, he told his father-in-law, "Don't leave us, because now we are going to travel into the land of Israel." So what are the first of these four things? Rishayna Siper Chanukas HaMizbeach, the dedication of the Mizbeach, as we said, of the dedication of the whole Mishkan. The Sheinis Zrizusam Be'inyan Chinuch HaLeviim, the fact that they were so quick to actually dedicate, as we said, and to wave and to prepare the Leviim to serve in the Mishkan. The third thing is this story, Zrizusam Be'Karban Pesach, the fact that they were very not just quick, but they were very careful and did the mitzvah of the Karban Pesach. And the fourth special thing, Revi'is, is the fact that comes right after this, Lechtam, Acharei Akel Yisbarach Bamidbar, they were going to follow Hashem into the desert, Afal Pi Shehayah Ha'alei Sa'anan Bizmanan Bilti Meidayim, even though they didn't get an itinerary, nobody told them how long the flight would be and when they're going to travel, and how long, it's interesting. I don't know, I'm always looking how many hours exactly, and it's meshuggah because it doesn't make it go any faster, it makes it go a lot slower. But anyways, they had no itinerary, they had no clue how long we're going to stop, how long we're going to start, when it's, you know, when we're called back on the plane, nothing, they have no idea. And they follow Hashem into the desert. So here the Sfarnu says these four special deeds were so special of the Jewish people that really, technically speaking, they could have entered the land of Israel immediately and had all the non-Jews run away, and they would have just inherited the land in such a beautiful, peaceful way. Let me just see how he says it. That's right, he says that they sometimes stayed longer, sometimes shorter, and they didn't have a clue when they would stop, when they would travel. Now he explains why it's in this order. It's not in chronological order. It's in order of what was more precious to Hashem, what was difficult for them. So it seems that dedicating the Mishkan was a very big thing, and dedicating the Levim was the second big thing. Bringing the Karban Pesach is the third big thing, and traveling the way they did into the desert following Hashem is the fourth big thing that they did, and this is why it's listed in this way. It doesn't have to do with when it happened, it has to do with more the fact that these are big incidences, these are big things that the Jewish people showed their love to Hashem and their dedication to Hashem. And that's what he says. The truth is that really was first. They're traveling because that they did right away when they left Egypt. That's why it says there's no order, chronological in Torah. But that's when you're looking at time. But when you're not looking at time and you look at the concepts, there is a proper order, but it's not by chronological order. It's more by what's valued and what makes sense to lead one story into the next story, into the next story of what matters. And of course, as a lesson for us in how we should feel towards Hashem and how we should act in our life. Okay, just wanted to see that Sforno. And now, I'm just thinking if we should... We'll go. I feel so bad. It's not so fast. You know, today we're a bit more technical. The next week we're going to see a few very beautiful, deep ideas. But I do want to go back into the Psukim to finish the Psukim. So we were on page 4, I think it was, in the Psukim. Just to read quickly the other Psukim that tells us what happened. Let's see. Okay. So on page 4, yes. Okay, so he tells them to stand and wait, and then Hashem answers him because he's Moshe. So it says, "Vayidaber Hashem to pasuk tes, Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe leimar." On page 4, "Daber al bnei Yisrael leimar ish ish ki yeh tamei lenefesh oy b'derech harchayka." And here he gives them the instruction: speak to the children of Israel, saying, "If any man will become impure through a corpse, or will be on a distant road." It's interesting what this means. On a distant road. On a distant road doesn't really mean far. It means if you're just outside of where you have to be to bring the korban, for whatever reason it may be that you're there and you're not in the Beis HaMikdash, what happens to a person? So he says, "Lachem oyle dereseichem v'asa pesach la'Hashem," whether you or your generations. So what should he do? He can still do a Pesach. How? So you see on page 5 in Pasuk Yud Aleph, "Bachaydesh Hasheni Barba Asar Yaim," on the 14th, in the second month. So now we're coming to the month of Iyar. You have an opportunity on the 14th day, Bein HaArbayim, similar to Pesach Rishayim. We'll see the differences in a second, but it's the 14th day of the second month in the afternoon. Yasu Aisai, he will make it, he will do it. Al Matzais Umroirim Yechlu. So he shall eat it on Matzis and Morah, right? Loy bot, let's see, he says, and what other halacha is there that's similar? Loy ashiru mimenu ad baiker. You know, with the Karban Pesach, you have to finish eating it. You cannot leave over after the morning. The etzem loy yishberuba, you're not allowed to break any of the bones. Kachal chukas ha Pesach yasu oisai, just like all the laws of the Karban Pesach, that's what you shall do with it. Although there are very major differences. What are the differences between Pesach Sheni and Pesach Rishen? Do you remember? What are the main differences? We're coming to Pesach now. We all know, and what happens now, we're going to be preparing for a long time to clean our house, because when we bring the Karban Pesach, or in our case, when we're going to be eating all the things that we're going to eat, the matzah, the murah, the whatever, and all the things that we mark the Karban Pesach, what must we get rid of? Chametz, exactly. What does it mean, get rid of chametz? How do we get rid of it? Yeah, we got to really get rid of it. If it's in our house, we have to sell it, right? It has to be gone. It's not ours. We cannot own it. We cannot have it, right? It's not ours. That's by the real Pesach, as we say, the first Pesach, Pesach Rishon. What happens by Pesach Sheni? If somebody wasn't able to keep Pesach, you know, the first Pesach, that's right, and they want to keep Pesach Sheni, do they have to get rid of all their chametz from their house? No, you don't. Very interesting. There, the chametz is in the house with you. You eat the matzah and the Karban Pesach. You don't eat the chametz together with the Karban Pesach, but it could still be in the house with you. How long is Pesach Rishayim? 7 days, right? 8 days out of Eretz. Eretz, 7 days. How long is Pesach Sheni? one day. It's a very different yontif. And yet it marks the same thing. It's like a second chance of the same thing, but it's kept in such a different way. It's very important to remember because it's spiritually they have different meanings. And that's why they have these two halachas that really fit with their spiritual connotation. And I'm going to share that before we finish today. I just want to read this next two psukim. Let's see what he says. So you do it and you don't leave anything over. And then he gives the clear halacha in Pasuk Yud Gimel. Va'ish asher utar u'bederech lo'yhoya v'chadal ases ha-pesach v'nichrosa ha-nefesh ha-hime ha-mea ki karban Hashem la-hikrib mayaday cheta yisa ha-ish ahu. So don't think that you can just be negligent. Here he's giving us a very important thing. He says, but a man who is pure and was not on the road and had refrained from making the Pesach offering, in other words, on purpose, he just can't be bothered, whatever it may be, and he doesn't bring Pesach in the right time, and he's not traveling, and he's not impure, what do we say about him? He gets kares. We know the famous part, the terrible part, because he should not be doing that, because it's a carbon for Hashem, and he's not bringing the carbon at the right time, and therefore he has to bear his sin. But then he says a very interesting, you know, before we do Pasuk Yedalot, because I think we're going to discuss that next week, why he mentioned specifically the ger, but I just want to share one nice thing about this thing that we just mentioned that we'll develop, and then we also have to go back to that first Rashi next week to understand this concept of the order in Torah. But such a fascinating thing. It says like this, that Pesach Rishon, it's the first Pesach, right? That's really, we don't call it Pesach Rishon, we just call it Pesach. And it's kept for 7 days, you get rid of all of your chametz. That was given to the Jewish people when they left Egypt and when they experienced the tremendous miracle where Hashem revealed himself from, you know, from such a great place, and he sort of plunked us out of Egypt, and we were almost like newborns actually on Pesach. That's when we became a new nation. So it says that that's the Jewish people on the level of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, a person who's doing things in the right order, in the right way, in the proper, you know, approach, where everything works. You know, when you do things in the right way, you do things organized. So, you know, one thing leads to the next. You do it with a seder. So it takes time. So the first Pesach, you first of all, there is no bad at all in the house. Why is there no bad? Very interesting. Why is there no chametz allowed? Because where do we get the strength to make that Pesach from? Who's giving us that strength? Who's giving us that holiness, so to speak? Where is it coming from? Hashem, exactly, totally from Hashem. The first time especially, Hashem took us out, we were out of nothing. And he just made, it's like somebody floods you with this great light, you know? He like gives you this boost of energy. And it's totally a high that's coming from something external, something from beyond yourself. It's wonderful, it's beautiful, it lifts you, but doesn't necessarily enter you very deeply inside you. It's just there, and it's just like everything, all the negativity has to be, so to speak, pushed away, right? You have to push it away. You can't deal with any of the negativity. It's sort of being outshined, but it might still be there. So you gotta lock it away, hide it away, sell it, get rid of it. And it takes 7 days because it's done with a seder. It's done properly. You know, you're like on that level of a tzaddik where you do things in an organized way. Pesach Sheni is a whole different thing. Pesach Sheni is somebody who was impure. And because they were impure, they weren't able to bring the carbon Pesach. They come to Moshe Rabbeinu, they're devastated. They come to Hashem, they're devastated. I was impure, I made a mistake, whatever it may be, if it's my fault, not my fault. The bottom line is I was in a place I shouldn't have been. What happens sometimes when we find ourselves feeling distant? Very interesting thing. So sometimes we can give up, that's the worst thing. But hopefully the best thing that can happen is that the distance can actually make you yearn much more, right? When a person is far, when a person feels distant, they feel a tremendous yearning to come close. You know, it's interesting. It's like we say, even in life, like when you have something constantly, you get used to it, you take it for granted. When something is far away from you, you don't take it for granted. You're very, very, very not stunned. You're just beyond excited. It's like when you see family that you don't live close to, there's such a deep, it's like such a deeper connection almost when you're with them, and there's no order. It's intense beyond. One day, it takes one day to experience that Pesach, and that's the level of a Baal Teshuva. That's the level where you are working. First of all, the yearning comes from you because you were distant and you made the mistake or whatever it may be, and now you want to reconnect. So you have this incredible yearning. So all of the negativity, all the things that was blocking between you and being able to come close, you've dealt with it, because otherwise you can't come close, right? So you deal with it. You deal with it in the way where you can actually transform it. Why can you transform it? And it's a very beautiful idea. The reason you can actually even transform the negativity is because it's the negativity itself that's giving you that sense of yearning. It's the distance that makes you treasure what you've lost more. And because of that, that distance becomes a positive thing. You realize, such a beautiful idea. The distance is not negative anymore. It's because of the distance that you want to come close. So now the distance is something positive, but you have to come close. You can't leave it at distance. That's not good enough. You don't want to stay far away. So that yearning takes all of that negativity and actually transforms it. It empowers you to come closer. So you're on the level of what we would term as a Baal Tshuva, which means you have this high, intense yearning to come close to Hashem. You do. And you don't have to get rid of the bad, because now the bad that's in your house, that was the impetus for change. That's a positive thing. That's a good thing. It's transformed. It's not negative anymore. Now you're using it in the positive way. And it's so intense, and it has no Seder, that in one day you can accomplish what it takes on the first Pesach to do for 7 days. So this is the difference in a spiritual sense between the first Pesach and the second Pesach. Next week in Ritz Hashem, we'll discuss more.